This is the Tax Update Podcast for January the 17th, 2009. This week, debt, foreclosures, and the tax law. The Tax Update Podcast, intended for tax professionals, and is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners are expected to do their own research to confirm items raised in this presentation before relying upon the positions presented. The podcast and document may be reproduced freely as long as no fee is charged for the use of this document or the audio file. Such prohibited use would include using this podcast or document as part of a CP presentation for which a fee is charged. The podcast is sponsored by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.lineberg-services.com. Lineberg Information Services offers email newsletters on tax-related matters, as well as access to a library of useful information to tax practitioners that subscribe to their services. Visit them on the web at www.lineberg-services.com. This past week, I spoke, along with Attorney Terry Essig in Phoenix, at the Arizona Forum for Improvement of Taxation's Winter 2009 seminar. And our, shall we say, upbeat discussion topic for the day involved all of the tax issues that involve when we have debts, foreclosures, and issues like that arising under the tax law. What we're going to consider today is a couple of issues. We're going to consider mainly the issue from the individual who is giving up the property and the potential impact of that from the tax standpoint versus the issue that we maybe look at when we had our discussion, which was about a three-hour total presentation. Terry was looking at it mainly from the perspective of the collectability or collections issue and who could move against you for what. I was looking at it from the tax standpoint of once we've got that issue decided as to who has liability and what liability remains regarding the property, what the tax consequences are going to be depending upon how that's structured. What I plan to talk to today, and is in the materials that I have available on the website that you're able to download and go along with this presentation, talks about the issue from the tax perspective. I'll also look at the end of this presentation on the impact of the individual that is retrieving back property. We all seem to have a few clients who sold a piece of property, carried the note, and now discovered that they're getting the property back. And we'll talk about the impact of the taxpayer when that happens. The first issue we've got to consider when a taxpayer gives up a piece of property, either voluntarily or involuntarily, when they're unable to meet the debt obligation, is the issue of which tax provision governs the taxation of the transaction. There are really two key provisions, and then a third provision that deals with a potential exception from taxation, that come into play when we have a piece of property and a piece of real estate, a debt, a secured debt, on a piece of property. The property is given up, and in exchange for the fact they couldn't pay on the debt. And generally, we found that in those cases, even if a lender has a right to pursue collection later, quite often the person involved who owes the money is not going to be in a position to pay them regardless, so the debt tends to be wiped out. But our problem becomes whether that debt was wiped out because the lender had no recourse to do anything but allow it to be wiped out, or whether the lender merely decided to forego their right to collect the excess over the value of the the excess still owed to them after they settled what they could with the value of the property. The basic provision that comes into play when we have a piece of property and we give something up and we have an exchange, remember, Section 1001 computes a gain or loss on sale or exchange of a piece of property. We can exchange a property for the debt. So I hold a debt, I owe you money. You agree to give up the debt. You know, I give you back the property, and will you take that in total or partial satisfaction of the debt in question? That's governed by Section 1001. And 1001, essentially, Regulation 1.1001-2A1, makes clear that a debt given up in exchange for a property is considered proceeds of the sale or exchange for purposes of computing a gain or loss. However, Regulation 1.1001-2A2 goes on to provide that the amount considered as proceeds of sale from this type or proceeds from the exchange in this transaction will not include any amounts that are considered discharge of indebtedness under Section 61A12. Now, we all should be aware of Section 61 because that's a section that generally has our overarching definition of what is income for income tax purposes and essentially pulls everything in, but just in case you don't think everything's broad enough, there's a list of very specific items listed under that so you have some examples. One of the examples found in Section 61A12 is specifically income from the cancellation of debt. If I've loaned you $10,000 and then that debt is canceled, that is income to you. What the issue of the regulation has is if we have a situation where a lender gives up a right to pursue collection in excess of the amount satisfied by the piece of property. For instance, I have a piece of property, I owe on the property $500,000. The piece of property currently is worth $250,000. The lender takes back the $250,000 and presuming no cost in the foreclosure, which is a huge simplifying assumption, but we'll use it for this purpose. There's still an outstanding debt of $250,000 available as of after the lender has taken back that property. If the lender chooses not to pursue collection of that, if they have the right to pursue collection, which is a key question, and they choose not to pursue it, that $250,000, that first $250,000 was the proceeds from sale, but that second $250,000 is going to be considered relief of debt. Now, a couple of key things come into play looking at that. First, the Section 1001 transaction is going to be gain or loss, most often on a capital asset. If it's a gain, we'll be subject to probably the 15% maximum tax rate, potentially the 25% recapture depreciation rate. But to the extent it is considered forgiveness of indebtedness under Section 61A12, that's not going to be capital gain. And that particular gain is going to be considered ordinary income if not otherwise blocked. Now we get to a couple of issues that we have various provisions in the code that allow us to escape taxation or not have to recognize income either though otherwise triggered. But they fall upon certain specific consequences. For instance, when we get to Section 121 of the code that involves gain on the sale of a personal residence, that gain can be excluded from income up to $250,000 for an individual, $500,000 for a married couple. But that only counts on the gain or loss on sale. If, rather than that, we have relief of indebtedness, 121, I should say, will not protect us. Similarly, if we have a loss on a disposition of a personal asset, that loss is non-deductible. However, it's possible that we'll net out to be very even on the transaction, but because the value of the property was lower, we could have a net loss on the sale computing 1001, but then have a chunk of ordinary income coming back at us under Section 61. In essence, while we put $500,000 into the property and, you know, we basically borrowed $500,000 to buy the property, it was worth $500,000 when we purchased it, and that's what we paid for it. The reality is if we walk away from it when it's worth $250,000 and the lender has a right of recourse, we end up with a $250,000 non-deductible loss and a $250,000 taxable gain that's ordinary income. Again, presuming none of the overriding provisions block that gain, and we'll talk about some of the provisions that may do so. One of the key provisions that may do so is Section 108. Section 108 allows us, in certain circumstances that we'll discuss, to exclude from income the cancellation of indebtedness. But now we have to consider the other side of the coin. If we have a gain on sale under 1001 and then some cancellation of indebtedness, Section 108 will protect us from the cancellation of indebtedness potentially, but won't do a thing for the gain on sale if there's a gain on sale inherent in the transaction as well. What that means is for any recourse debt, we have to break the transaction into its two components. The portion that is a gain or loss on sale that's governed by 1001 and the relevant provisions that impact gains on sale, as well as a forgiveness of indebtedness under Section 61, that we then look to those provisions and figure out how they impact us. If a piece of property is secured by a note that is non-recourse, a lender has given up the right to be reimbursed, shall we say, for the excess over the excess of the debt owed over the fair value of the property if they take it back. In a true non-recourse debt, the lender has agreed that I can pay off that mortgage either by writing him a check for the $500,000 or simply handing him the keys to the building. And either one of those will be full satisfaction of the debt. If I have a true non-recourse debt, there is no gain or loss from cancellation of indebtedness because there is no cancellation of indebtedness. I did full satisfaction per the contract by giving back the property. The lender had no right to pursue me. All they could do was take back the property and use that in full satisfaction. So, as you may guess, a key issue, and one of the ones we discussed pretty heavily at the AFIT seminar, involved the question of what is and what is not a recourse or non-recourse debt. Now, the reality is that definition is primarily going to be a legal definition that's going to be looked at for the property rights involved of the individual. As well, many states have provisions in their statute that provide that certain loans, a lender is not going to be allowed, despite the fact that the paperwork may say so, the lender will not be allowed to pursue collection in excess of the value of the property. In the particular case at AFIT, Terry discussed the Arizona anti-deficiency statute and got into a discussion as to whether or not that statute would serve to convert what was otherwise a recourse debt for tax purposes into a non-recourse debt. Now, we're going to talk about those, but realize anti-deficiency statutes of that sort exist in a lot of states. Every one of them is different, and potentially the tax consequences of each one may be different, as well as which property is going to qualify to fall under that. For those of us in tax practice, a key question initially is going to be, though, getting to the determination of whether or not we have a recourse or non-recourse debt. And that will quite often involve rulings on matters that don't impact tax law, but rather going to be an application of the property law of the state in question and the rights of a creditor in the state in question, which quite often means that if you're not skilled in that area or you're not an attorney, you may need to get independent counsel to give you an idea, or get the client's counsel to give you a ruling on what the rights of the lender are or would have been in this transaction. Now, in publication 4681, the IRS actually provides a table for working through this bifurcated sale calculation, where we split the part that's going to be gain or loss on the sale versus the ordinary income from cancellation of indebtedness. If you look in that publication, you'll find Table 1-1 has a worksheet for foreclosures and repossessions. That worksheet is reproduced in the materials. As always, the materials are on my website. You can find the link there at www.edzollerstaxupdate.com. That worksheet gives us a starting point to break the two pieces in half. Now, as noted, in the case of non-recourse debt, only Section 1001 is going to come into play, because the lender only has the right to take the property in satisfaction of the debt. The gain or loss rules will come into play. Potentially, Section 121 may be involved as a personal residence. Other rules may be involved depending upon what else comes into play. Or we may have capital gains, capital losses, Section 1231 gains, Section 1231 losses. In the example in the material, we're going to talk about a case where Joe bought a rental property for $200,000 in 2004. And Joe put down $10,000 and borrowed $190,000 on a debt that, per its terms, was non-recourse. In 2008, the value of the property had dropped to $100,000. Joe defaults on the debt, hands the key back over to the lender, and says, "It's yours, take it." At the time of his turning it back over, the balance of the debt was $180,000, and depreciation taken to date was $10,000. Joe has a net 1231 loss of $10,000 with a sales price of the outstanding debt, $180,000, less the basis of the property, which in this case would be $190,000, the $200,000 additional original cost, minus the $10,000 depreciation. In this fact pattern, the fair market value of $100,000 isn't relevant in our concern for tax purposes because it doesn't enter into our calculation. The results will be very different when we consider a recourse debt in that case. As noted, this particular issue isn't really a problem, produces a loss, but it could be a problem if essentially we produces a gain, and the taxpayers are going to be confused, not understanding how they could have a gain when, as far as they're concerned, they lost the property. Let's change the facts just a little, and let's move to example two. In this case, let's presume Joe had taken depreciation of $40,000 on the property before giving it back up, lowered its basis to $160,000. Now when he gives back the property's taken back, the $180,000 worth of debt is now given up in exchange is now in excess of the sales price of the property. For that reason, we have a 1231 gain on disposition of $20,000, and that gain would represent unrecaptured Section 1250 depreciation, which by that extent means that we have a 25% maximum rate. Note that even if Joe was bankrupt or insolvent, or covered any of the other parts of 108 appear relevant to him, it would not impact this transaction. Insolvency won't help Joe in this case, because in this case, it is a sale of the property for the debt, which produces a gain which is not excludable under Section 108 of the code. Rather, if Joe owns the property at the time this transaction takes place, Joe's going to be nailed for the $20,000 of gain, even if Joe has no other assets. Reminder, the test of recourse versus non-recourse comes under state law. And consider the potential impact of any anti-deficiency statutes or other rulings that impact the nature of various loans. For instance, in Arizona, the anti-deficiency statute can impact properties that aren't used as your personal residence but are used by somebody as a personal residence. The Arizona rule, as explained by Terry at the conference, involves a piece of property that has up to two living areas and is under 2.5 acres and was used as a residence by somebody during that time, doesn't have to be the person who owns it. That can produce a non-recourse debt under Arizona. That could produce a arguably non-recourse debt. And we got into a discussion as to whether the IRS would or would not accept the view of that being a non-recourse debt. If we do have a Section 1001 sale, remember, we're now looking at the things like the Section 121 exclusion if it's a principal residence. We're looking at the other rules for taxation under capital gains 1231, but we're not looking at Section 108 if the debt has no recourse provision. At least if the debt has no recourse provision and we're not simply being let out of it, in this case, or let out in terms of reduction of the principal. Could conceivably have an issue if we actually had forgiveness of indebtedness. Now, a recourse debt, if the debt's recourse, then we have a transaction that's split into two separate transactions, as mentioned earlier. The fair value of the property taken, or the proceeds essentially that are applied against the debt, reduces the outstanding obligation to the lender. That's going to be the Section 1001 sales proceeds. However, the remainder, which the lender had the right to pursue collection from the individual for the amount of, but which the lender chooses not to, that amount will end up being a forgiveness of indebtedness under Section 61A12. Let's take example three again. We're going to modify Joe and the debt one more time. Again, he buys a rental property for $200,000, puts down $10,000, borrowed $190,000 on a recourse debt. In 2008, the value of the property had dropped to $100,000 when Joe defaulted on the debt. At the time, the balance of the debt was $180,000 and depreciation taken to date again was $10,000. Joe has a net 1231 loss of $90,000 because the sales price now is going to be, again, we're presuming no cost involved in this foreclosure. Everything works perfectly, so we get full $100,000 value, less the basis of the property. So we have $100,000 fair value. The basis of the property is $190,000. So we have a $90,000 Section 1231 loss. The remaining $80,000 of debt becomes now ordinary income under Section 61A12, which is forgiveness of indebtedness, cancellation of the debt. That cancellation of the debt is going to be ordinary income. Once again, we then consider whether potentially we could exclude that cancellation of debt under one of the provisions of Section 108. But the example can get even nastier for Joe. Let's presume Joe bought that was not a rental but a vacation property, put down $10,000, borrowed $190,000 on a recourse debt. In 2008, again, the value of the property dropped to $100,000. He defaults on the debt. He was unable to obtain financing, let's presume as many people in this economy. He bought it on one of those teaser interest rates, and there was a balloon payment coming due in 2008. He couldn't get it refinanced. He walks away from the property. Well, in this case, he has a non-deductible loss on $100,000 on the sale of property. It was personal use property, sales price of $100,000, basis of $200,000. However, he still has that $80,000, or the $90,000 in this case, $190,000, presuming you pay interest only, $90,000 of gain from the discharge of indebtedness, or not discharge in this case, cancellation of indebtedness. That $90,000 is going to be ordinary income to him unless he can qualify under this one of the 108 provisions that will allow him to exclude that amount from income. In that particular case, we can have a lot of odd things happening. And potentially that could be a problem if we had the same situation occur, where, let's say, Bob and Mary bought their principal residence back in the 70s for $40,000 and had paid off the mortgage entirely by the end of the 90s. They saw their home rise in value during the late 90s and the early part of 2000 and decided, hey, you know, everybody's telling us we're stupid if we don't borrow the max out and basically monetize the house, because we know it's going to keep going up 20% in value every year, so we can just live off our house forever. Well, that didn't turn out to work so well for most people in the economy these days, but a lot of people were trying it. So now he's borrowed $400,000 against a home equity in 2004 on an interest-only loan. Turns out it's time to come to pay the piper. He no longer can borrow money to pay off the loans, because, by the way, that was how a lot of people were paying this. They'd refinance again. That gave him the cash to, again, make the payments in the future, as well as go buy the cars and take the vacations. So he finds he can't get refinanced. It's a recourse loan, and the home is now worth $200,000. The lender takes it back. Now, the good news is, you know, he has for part of it, he's got a gain. $200,000 sales price again, because that's the fair value of the property, minus the $40,000 basis, or a gain of $160,000. But his problem is the remaining $200,000 of debt is going to be considered forgiven by the lender, considered a cancellation of indebtedness, which makes that ordinary income of $200,000. Even though the total gain of $360,000, had it been a sale of the property for $400,000, would have been excludable under 121. 121's not going to help him for that last $200,000. If he does not qualify for one of the relief provisions under Section 108, or only partially qualifies, he may find out he still has ordinary income at the end of the day from this transaction. Due to the various treatments under the law and special cases for gains, when gains can be excluded, for when the debt can be excluded, various limitations on deductions of losses, etc., you can't say as a general rule it's going to be better for the taxpayer from a tax standpoint if the debt's treated as recourse or non-recourse. You have to actually look at the case in question, run the numbers, and look at which provisions impact both sides of the transaction for your client, to determine whether the client would have been better off had the whole thing been treated as a sales transaction, or whether the client is better off when it's treated as split between recourse and non-recourse. If we have a forgiveness of debt, we look at the Section 108 gain exclusion provisions. The default is any of this income is considered ordinary income for tax purposes. We don't have an option there. Section 108 gives us a relief provision, and it provides five criteria when income from discharge of indebtedness will not be considered taxable income. That occurs in five cases. First, if the discharge occurs in a Title 11 bankruptcy case, the debt covered by the discharge is not going to be considered ordinary income. Second, if the discharge occurs while the taxpayer is insolvent. Third, if the discharge is qualified farm indebtedness. Now, in the presentation, we're not going into that one too far because it wasn't relevant for most of the group in Phoenix, but that is an option you need to consider. We're not going to talk about much in today's presentation either. Fourth option, the taxpayer is other than a C corporation. C corporations can't avail themselves of this one. They can of the others. And the indebtedness discharge is qualified real property business indebtedness. Or the fifth option, the indebtedness discharge is qualified principal residence indebtedness, which is discharged now before January 1st, 2013. Originally, it was going to be a much shorter run. Now we get it all the way through 2013. Now, it's not a free lunch if you get Section 108 treatment. Rather, taxpayers who make use of 108 will generally need to reduce the attributes of some assets. Either tax benefit, tax carryover provisions will be reduced, or the basis of assets will be adjusted to reflect the discharge, the amount that was not picked up as income. But generally, that's not a bad result because it's paying tax today, or potentially understanding somewhere down the line you might have to pay some extra tax later. In this particular case, it's much better to get out of it today. The main pair of options that everybody's aware of using on 108 is insolvency and bankruptcy. Now, I'm not going to talk to you much about the bankruptcy because that's a detailed issue. Just to remind you that it does need to be a discharge under the Bankruptcy Code of the United States government. And as you're aware, a few years ago, there were some major modifications made to the Bankruptcy Code. These mods can have a significant impact on what the date of discharge is and what exactly worked for that point. But if it's not subject to formal discharge in bankruptcy, which is often the case, the more general rule involves the insolvency exception, which is the one probably that most of us have encountered before under Section 108. Debt relief is excluded from income to the extent a taxpayer is insolvent prior to the discharge. But if the discharge makes the taxpayer solvent to the extent they become solvent afterward, that part of the gain will be subject to tax. Let's consider an example that doesn't relate to real estate right now, just to have a standalone debt forgiveness. Linda went out and has credit card debt of $20,000 that the lender has agreed to accept $5,000 as full payoff of that $20,000 debt. That would relieve Linda of $15,000 in debt. That debt is the only debt Linda held. Prior to discharge, the total value of Linda's assets were $10,000. So prior to discharge, she was insolvent by $10,000. Therefore, $10,000 of the $15,000 debt relief is excluded under Section 108A1B. The remaining $5,000, because of the effect of Section 108A3, is going to be brought into taxable income as ordinary income, because that $5,000, she was no longer insolvent once we got over that hump of going for the $5,000 beyond. Now, while we make this simple and an example just tell you what their assets were worth and what the liabilities were, computing insolvency is not quite as simple as that. The IRS position is that a taxpayer must include all assets when determining a taxpayer's solvency, including those that could not be reached in bankruptcy due to state law protection. In Technical Advice Memorandum 1995-35002, the IRS outlined that position, noting it was consistent with their view of congressional intent. And in Carlson v. Commissioner, 116 Tax Court No. 9, the tax court went along and held that the definition of the term which Congress adopted for purposes of Section 108 does not specifically exclude assets from a debtor that are exempt from the claims of creditors under applicable state law or any other Title 11 exempt property in determining whether the debtor is insolvent. Insolvent therefore means that total value of assets, regardless of whether a creditor could reach them in bankruptcy, exceed or are less than the total value of all liabilities. Therefore, theoretically, if you could get a discharge, you could get debts which would be available for discharge in bankruptcy and would be not subject to gain inclusion under 108. If the taxpayer is not in bankruptcy, doesn't obtain a discharge in bankruptcy, those same debts could be taxable income because the taxpayer will not be deemed to be insolvent for Section 108A1B. Taxpayers basically have to count those otherwise exempt assets. That can make a significant difference. For CPAs, we have another potential problem we have to face. Statements on Standards for Evaluation Services No. 1 took effect January 1, 2008, over a year ago, and it imposes standards on CPAs who value what it calls subject interest. Subject interest includes any ownership interest in a business and any intangible assets. Both of those may be found with many of our clients in when we put together their total assets and liabilities to determine solvency or insolvency. If the client wishes for us to provide the value of that asset, we have to comply with SSVS number 1. Now, SSVS number 1 has an exception that says that we can accept the client's valuation. Well, that's fine, or from a third party. But for purposes of a tax return position under SSTS number 1, Statements on Standards for Tax Services, or under the IRS Circular 230 for signing a return that has substantial authority. We have to consider the facts we know, and if the client has no ability or really obviously is not competent to determine the valuation of the property, and we don't know, you know, at this point, we're not sure we have enough confidence in saying the taxpayer is insolvent because remember, or is insolvent by what amount, because remember, this exception is limited to the amount of the insolvency that existed on the date that the cancellation took place, then we may have a problem with our return. Now, those of you who think, wait, I don't do evaluations, so it can't be impacted by SSVS number one, I suggest you look in the materials. Illustration 12H, which was the appendix in SSVS number one to explain its application, specifically deals with the problem of Section 108 and valuation. It notes specifically, and I quote, if the company must rely on the insolvency provisions of IRC Section 108, B, one or more of the assets for which value is relevant under Section 108 is a subject interest, that is a business ownership interest, security, or intangible asset. The company or third party does not provide the valuation, and the member, meaning the CPA, applies valuation approaches and methods and uses professional judgment to value the subject interest for purposes of the 108D3 insolvency determination, the statement applies. If the statement applies, that imposes both performance and reporting standards on the CPA. So be careful. You've got to go through both the SSVS and the SSTS standards if you're a CPA to get around this issue. If we have an amount either under the insolvency or the bankruptcy provision that is excluded from income, then we must reduce tax attributes in a specific order. Now, this reduction of attributes takes place at the end of the tax year in which the discharge or cancellation takes place. That means we are allowed to make use of these attributes that float into the year, but we're not going to be able to make use of them following the year that we canceled the debt or we excluded debt from cancellation or we had a discharge for which we excluded a debt from income. The order of these is set by the code, but there's an optional restructuring of this that you can make use of in the code and regs. But the general order is we first reduce net operating losses, choosing first to reduce the NOL for the current year, and then any net operating loss being carried into the current year. We lose $1 of net operating loss for every dollar of excluded canceled debt. If we still have canceled debt that's not, we've exhausted the NOLs and there still was more canceled debt left over, we go on to the next category. Category 2 is general business credit carryover. Those carryovers to or from the current year reduce at the rate of 33 1/3 cents for each dollar of debt forgiveness. You'll find with credits, we tend to use this 33 1/3 cents number, meaning that for every $3 of debt forgiveness, we lose $1 of credit. If the general business credit carryover and the NOL haven't absorbed everything, so we still have loss available, we next have to reduce our minimum tax credit, again with that 1/3 value. So for every $3 of loss that make it to this third tier, we're going to lose $1 of minimum tax credit. We've gotten this far, still have losses to go. We next reduce our capital loss carryovers. Any carryover is reduced, followed by loss carryovers into the current year. So any carryover we produce this year is reduced, then any carryovers in the current year are reduced. Still with remaining losses, we then go to basis in property. Now these basis in property can electively be moved up, at least parts of them, to the very beginning of the allocation. But if we don't make the election, we will pick them up down here after we've wiped out our net operating loss, after we've taken care of our general business credit, minimum tax credit, and taken care of the capital loss. Basis is reduced per the regulations of Section 1017, which govern this basis reduction, in the following order. Real property used in the trade or business or held for investment that secured the debt in question is the first thing to be reduced. Secondly, personal property used in the trade or business that secured the canceled debt is next reduced. Third, property other than inventory, accounts and notes receivable or real property held primarily for the sale to customers. It means other assets used in the business that weren't real property or personal property, but were not inventory. We reduce the basis of those other assets that are in the business. Finally, we reduce inventory, accounts and notes receivable, and real property held primarily for sale to customers. And if we wiped out all that, we next go to personal use property. If losses continue beyond this point, if I should say the bad debt cancellation, we still have some available, we reduce passive activity losses and credit carryovers, again, dollar for dollar on the carryover for the passive activity loss, and the credits are at 33 1/3 cents a dollar. And the final thing to be reduced, if we still have losses that we haven't, if we still had cancellation of debt we've not been able to exhaust, is the foreign tax credit at 1/3, basically $1 foreign tax credit loss for each $3 of cancellation of debt excluded, that makes it all the way down to this seventh tier. If we get past that tier and still have cancellation of debt, under these provisions, we're scot-free. That's never going to come back and have a negative tax impact on us. The taxpayer can elect to reorder this as noted, and it can reduce the basis of depreciable property first in lieu of reducing the basis of any other attributes that occurs earlier in this list. The taxpayer can also elect to treat real property held for sale to customers, not any other, but real property, as if it were depreciable property for these purposes. Once that election is made, it can only be revoked with the consent of the IRS. We have a couple of special rules that also apply. We're not going to talk about the qualified farm indebtedness, but let's talk about qualified principal residence indebtedness, because that's got a lot of interest given the current market conditions and given the fact that a lot of taxpayers got in over their heads on residences. So a lot of those taxpayers now are finding their residences are either in foreclosure or being foreclosed. The statistics I saw yesterday that was noted was that in Nevada, 7% of all houses, basically residential property, has had at least some notice of foreclosure. The foreclosure process has gotten to some point during the past year. So there could be an awful lot of taxpayers impacted by these provisions, ultimately, if in fact they all end up losing the house. Now, as we noted before, when a taxpayer's residence is taken to pay off the mortgage and the property is worth less than the balance of the mortgage, if the mortgage was recourse and the lender does not pursue the taxpayer to collect remaining balance on the loan, there's going to be two transactions. There'll be a sale of the residence for its fair value. That sale is taxed under the standard Section 121 rules or the rules that disallow a deduction for losses on sales of personal assets. If there's a gain, then the exclusion goes with the 2-5-year rule we all know about that goes on sale of personal residence. If the mortgage is recourse, the taxpayer still owes the lender the balance of the loan after we get part done with that satisfaction from taking back the property. Quite often, the lender's not going to pursue collection of this, but that's going to be considered cancellation of debt income and, absent a 108 provision, would be subject to ordinary income. This particular effect was noted, and Congress passed the provision back early last year that allowed us to exclude qualified principal residence indebtedness. Now, originally that was going to go out of the code after this year, 2009. Now it's going to stay in the code all the way through 2012. That was a late year law change that Congress made. So we're going to have this provision around for a few years. In this particular case, the exclusion, you can get a benefit, but again, this benefit's only going to help for a non-recourse loan, or for a recourse loan, remember. For a non-recourse loan, we're never getting to Section 108, in which case this provision can never work for us there. If we have a non-recourse loan and we're getting gain on sale, we're just going to have to worry and hope that 121 helps us, because this section will not help us. But if we are eligible for relief, then the eligibility for relief says that we have to meet the following conditions. The residence has to be the taxpayer's principal residence as defined in Section 121. That means we need to meet the definitions of what is our principal residence, and we will consider cases, as we've discussed before, the Guinan case that discussed what was a taxpayer's principal residence. We only have one at a time, and we have to be using it as our principal residence at the time this debt cancellation comes into play. That debt can be no more than $2 million of acquisition indebtedness, as defined under Section 163H. Generally, 163H tells us how much debt we can have and include for purposes of the deductible home mortgage interest deduction. And as many of you are aware, that's limited to $1 million for home mortgage debt outstanding that was acquisition debt. However, for purposes of this exclusion, we're going to play as if that number was $2 million and count debt up to $2 million for this exclusion. Note that it will not apply if the debt was not qualified residence debt. Why wouldn't it be qualified residence debt? A couple of key reasons. First, it may be a home equity line of credit. Home equity lines of credit that weren't used to substantially improve the property are not going to be considered as qualified residence interest. Now, if a home equity line of credit was used to substantially improve the property, that will qualify for this purpose. Similarly, again, back to the go-go years starting this decade where taxpayers were borrowing out the cash in their residence and using it to buy home or using it to buy a car, perhaps using it to buy an investment property. Many taxpayers would take the money out of their house and go buy another property. Well, that debt's not going to be qualified residence debt because it's not going to trace back and not going to be considered qualified acquisition indebtedness, which is the problem we need to have. So it will not be subject to this one. If you have that type of debt, you've got to go back to the insolvency or bankruptcy provisions for the relief you're going to be looking for. Finally, the exclusion does not apply if the debt forgiveness is given in exchange for services performed for the lender or any other reason not related to the financial condition. Let's consider an example of the application of this. Jim and Mary purchased their residence in March of 2006 for $1,000,005 with an interest-only loan that was recourse for $1,400,000 after putting $100,000 down. The house has always been used as a principal residence while they owned it, and it was foreclosed upon by the lender when the house was worth $750,000. They have a gain on cancellation of indebtedness of $650,000, the difference between the $1,400,000 and the $750,000 that reduced the balance of the debt. They are eligible to exclude that under Section 108A1E since the debt meets the requirements for being qualified residence interest as defined at 108H, ignoring the $1,000,000 cap and allowing a squall up to $2 million of such debt. Any amount excluded under this provision, however, does have to reduce the basis of the residence of the taxpayer, though not below zero if the taxpayer continues to hold the residence. However, if it works to taxpayer's benefit, they can elect to have the insolvency rules apply instead of these rules. Major impact there obviously is going to be not on the exclusion of gain, because we're probably going to get that out either way, but rather on which attributes are reduced. Does the home get nailed first, or do the attributes go against the other assets, net operating losses, and other property? If the debt is only partially qualified residence indebtedness, then only the amount of the loan in excess of the amount not constituting qualified residence indebtedness is eligible for relief under the provisions. Remember, you've got to meet the principal residence requirement. Review the Guinan case. We have some information in your materials about the Guinan case and the issue where a taxpayer tried to have their cake and eat it too. If suddenly the realization dawns upon you that this had to be my principal residence about the day the lender takes it away, but you had never taken that position before on your returns, don't be surprised the IRS and the courts aren't too thrilled with the position. In the Guinan's case, it was gain on sale of their property. In our cases, it may be exclusion of the debt, of the cancellation of indebtedness from income. Now, the problem becomes with us also, acquisition debt is a major problem here. As noted, when we have that example where the individuals borrowed money, in this particular case, they borrowed $1,000,005 interest only. That, again, was the individual that bought their house way back in the 60s for $40,000. It rose in value to $2 million in 2006, and they basically borrowed out $1,000,005 at that time. Later, the home is foreclosed upon when it's worth only $750,000 on a recourse debt. They'll have a gain on the sale of homes of $710,000, which represents the $750,000 proceeds left the $40,000 basis in the home. Of that $710,000 gain, $500,000 can be excluded under Section 121. Note that even if they are insolvent at this point, they're not going to escape that $210,000, because that $210,000 is gain on sale, not relief from indebtedness. The remaining $750,000 is cancellation of indebtedness income if the lender does not pursue collection against them. To the extent Jim and Mary are not insolvent after cancellation of debt, that would be ordinary income. The one thing to remember is that Congress gave us a $2 million cap here too. That's one that you may find in many cases. We're so used to the $1 million cap. Remember, for this discharge provision, we still have a cap, but the cap is $2 million and not $1 million. As noted, the relief cannot be related to the financial condition of the homeowner. If it appears, and basically this is a smell test, but if it appears somebody's trying to use this as a backdoor way to compensate somebody for some other action, you're not going to be able to exclude it at that point. The cancellation has to be shown to be related to the financial condition of the homeowner. Qualified real property indebtedness is the next one we're looking at. That's a special exemption for real property for taxpayers other than C corporations that represented business property. To qualify for the treatment, the debt has to meet the following requirements. It has to be incurred with and secured by the property used in the trade or business. It must either have been taken out before 1993 or has to be qualified acquisition indebtedness or used to refinance the debt that was incurred before 1993. Basically, after 93, we have to show that we used it to acquire the property or substantially improve that. Taxpayer elects to have this provision apply by filing a Form 982, which, by the way, is a form we always file in order to claim the 108 exemptions. But this particular provision is elective. The other provisions will apply unless you step up and say, I want this one in. And that's important because this election must be made on a timely filed return for the year in question. So if you don't file your return timely, you cannot make use of this provision. So taxpayers who don't get around to filing their return by October 15th may have a nasty surprise if they needed this provision to give themselves relief from forgiveness of indebtedness. The election is eligible for an automatic maximum of 6-month extension of the election under Regulation 301.9100-2. That allows taxpayers who may file in April to make up their mind still by October 15th if they're going to go ahead and make the election to use this method to exclude the debt from their income. Qualified acquisition debt, which is one of the key definitions here for for 1993 and later debt, that was either incurred or assumed to acquire, construct, reconstruct, or substantially improve the real property that secures the debt, or resulted from the refinancing of debt that met those requirements, again, limited to the balance of the qualified acquisition indebtedness of that first debt at the date of refinancing. If the exclusion for either a bankruptcy cancellation or insolvency cancellation also apply, they must be applied first before this one. So again, we apply those two. Now we're still got a debt that's going to be included in income. Now we got to make sure on Form 982 we've made the election if we want to make use of that for this purpose. The total amount we can exclude is limited by the excess of the outstanding principal balance of the note prior to cancellation over the fair market value of the property in question, after, of course, being reduced by the exclusions for insolvency or bankruptcy. It cannot exceed the adjusted basis of the depreciable real property held before cancellation after applying any other attributes reductions. So we're limited there. As you may guess, that limit's there because we have to take this cancellation and use it to reduce the basis of that property. This case is no ordering of attributes. We simply have to go against a specific property and reduce its basis. Now, the 108 provisions are ones that, unfortunately, due to the current economy, we're going to have to get a lot more used to using. So it's not a bad idea to review those and consider with your clients. A lot of them are going to be shocked that they face potential tax liability when they've lost a piece of property. In their mind, there shouldn't be any liability because I lost something. You may have to educate them of the problems and the need to get together the necessary information, because most often the provision that's going to work best for us will be the insolvency provision, but that involves documenting the actual financial condition of the taxpayer at the time that the debt was canceled. What about those taxpayers on the other side of a transaction? That is, one who sold the real property, carried the note, and now discover that the purchaser can't pay anymore and they take back the property. Well, in that case, we have to consider what happens on the reacquisition. And on the reacquisition, there can be only a gain recognized. No losses recognized on reacquisition. Losses cannot be recognized until we later sell the property again. But gain is recognized if we sold the installment basis, limited to the lesser of the amount of money or other property received from the buyer prior to repossession, reduced by the gain originally reported in prior years. So we take that particular amount, we look at the money and other property received from the buyer prior to repossession, so basically the collections we had on the note, and we reduce that by the amount of gain we'd previously recognized and recognize that difference now as gain. or the original gain reduced by gain recognized in years prior to repossessions added to the amount of money or fair value of property paid by the seller in connection with reacquisition of the property. Be things like legal fees paid to reclaim the property. We have an example here, number 9. Denise sold a piece of land to April in 2005. Original sales price was $1 million. Denise had a basis of $500,000. That gives her a gross profit percentage for the installment basis of 50%. Prior to 2008, she'd collected $100,000 of the principal on the note, reported $50,000 of gain. In 2008, after the property declined in value to $400,000, she ended up taking back the property and received no additional principal in the year of sale. She paid legal fees of $10,000 in order to take back the property. Denise's gain on repossession is $50,000. That represents the total she collected in principal on the note, $100,000, reduced by the gain previously recognized. The numbers lower than under the alternative calculation, where the total gain from the transaction was $500,000, reduced by the prior gain recognized, $50,000, and expenses paid by Denise to reacquire the property, $100,000. That would give a potential gain of $490,000 she picked up. Obviously, $440,000, I should say, that she would pick up. That obviously is much higher than the $50,000. She picks up the $50,000, which is essentially the cash she received, which previously had been a return of basis and now is going to basically come back out as taxable gain because she got the property back. The basis of the property is the basis of the debt prior to repossession increased by any gain recognized on repossession and by the seller's repossession cost. So in the example we just get, her new basis in the note would be her basis in the note to start with, $900,000 face value less $450,000 of unrecognized gain or $450,000, increased by the $50,000 gain recognized, jumping the basis to $500,000, and increased by her cost of repossession, which is $10,000, giving her a new base of $510,000. In fact, the property may be worth substantially less than $500,000, we said it was worth $400,000, is irrelevant. She's got to sell that property now to trigger that remaining loss. A special rule applies if the property had gain excluded under Section 121. That's where we sold it as our home. And the problem there becomes, what if we turn down and resell it again? Under the standard rules, we get a new date basis, and we never would use the property as principal residence. So if we later sell it now at a gain, probably a reduced gain, but still would be a gain, then we're going to have a potential problem with our transaction because we may not be able to exclude that gain from income because we won't meet the 205 test for use and ownership. The law provides that in that case, if the property is disposed of within 1 year from the date it's reacquired, the entire sale is calculated and the exclusion is calculated as if it was all part of the original sale back on the date it was sold, where the taxpayer qualified for 121 treatment. However, if we go beyond that 1 year period, then we don't have that, we can't combine it any longer, and this sale stands on its own. Example 11, Maria sold her old residence to Mark in 2004 for $250,000. She had a basis of $150,000 in residence at the time, and she qualified to exclude the full $150,000 in gain under Section 121. Mark was unable to qualify for a mortgage at the time, so Maria carried the entire balance of sales price as an installment sale. By the beginning of 2008, she collected $5,000 in principal in addition to the interest on the note. Mark defaults on the note, and on June 30, 2008, she took back the property. She already has another residence. She's not going to move back into this one and start using again to meet the 2 out of 5 rule on it. So she sold the property for $250,000 on November 15th of 2008. For purposes of Section 121, she's treated as having sold the property for $255,000 second sale price plus the $5,000 she already collected. And we look back for her use and ownership status as of the 2004 sales date to determine if she qualifies for Section 121 exclusion, which it will turn out she does. If the property is not disposed of within that 1 year period, then the standard rules would apply. The same rules apply except that Maria is unable to dispose of the property until July 15, 2009. That's not an unusual situation in today's housing market. Properties stay on the market for quite a while, again for $250,000. In this case, she basically is not able to look back to 2004 and combine the sales. Rather, she first computes her basis in the property she took back by taking on the basis in the note, $245,000 face value. When she sells the property for $250,000, she has a $5,000 long-term capital gain that will be taxable as she does not meet the two-year use test of Section 121 at this time. The provisions for installment sales and the provision for 108 are an unfortunate consequence that we're seeing for many taxpayers of the economic events of the past year and probably of the economic events of the coming year. So we need to be aware of how these work. You need to discuss with your clients their exposure and as well make them aware that if they're facing a problem or potential loss piece of property, and we're going to need to make use of the insolvency provisions, that we need to get down and tie down their financial condition as of that time so they avoid going from bad to worse, not only losing the property but having to pay a large tax bill because we can't demonstrate their insolvency at the time the property is taken back. As always, this has been the Tax Update Podcast. I'm returning my way back now. I've come back and I've got all my lectures done for the year after spending a week up in Montana in Helena, where I guess we had all-time record high while I was there for that date in January, but the record high was 51. Unfortunately, there was enough snow that we didn't ever worry about getting rid of the snow. It was already there. We just kind of had lots of water going around while I was there as the snow kept melting, and eventually the freezing came back in. The snow hadn't gone away, so we had a whole bunch of the old snow and the new snow just for fun before I left. So I'm back from that, so I should be able to keep up these podcasts much more regularly coming forward. As well, I'm getting my schedule together for next year, and hopefully once all that gets published and the state societies publish where we're going, I'll let you know what I'm going to be lecturing on next year. But it looks like I've got a few dates already in play. This has been the Tax Update. Remember, it's brought to you by Lambert Information Services, located on the web at www.lambertservices.com. Be sure to visit Lambert Services for information on their newsletters and consider subscribing to those newsletters. This has been the Tax Update.